Hey,
welcome to
Urban Planning is Not Boring. I'm Sam.
And I'm Nat.
Okay, hello guys. Welcome back to another episode of Urban Planning is Not Boring. You have Sam and Nat today, joined by a very special guest. So we're going to be discussing hostile architecture and the impacts of hostile architecture on communities and the built environment. And joining us is our repeat guest, Jonathan Pacheco-Bell, who is now a senior embedded planner at Four Leaf Inc. We are so excited to have him here to discuss this topic. Jonathan recently appeared on the Decoder Ring and KJZZ NPR Phoenix podcast, where he was able to kind of discuss the inequities in public spaces that is caused by hostile architecture. So we first want to welcome Jonathan back to the podcast. Sam and I are both so excited to have you here. And then also just want to leave some space if you have anything that you want to add into the intro.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's really great to be back. It feels like we're just a bunch of old friends always chit-chatting, and it happens to be about urban planning. First and foremost, I want to say welcome back to you all, to Sam and Nat. It was a surprise when we saw the notice that y'all had to take some time, but that's okay. Sometimes life intervenes. So I get it. And I was in my mind, I was like, whenever they're ready, that's when we're ready. So I think on behalf of all your listening audience, welcome back. Really glad to have you. And congratulations on all that you've been accomplishing in the last year. There's been life moves. There's been career moves. There's been promotions. There's been conferences and awards. And on that note, I have to say congratulations to you both for receiving the APA Los Angeles and APA Inland Empire Communications Awards for this podcast. It's just incredible that you were able to get that in the same year. And I also got to sit with Natalie and at the APA Inland Empire Awards ceremony. Yeah. So it was really great to just get together and talk about life and explore some of the ideas for what we're going to talk about today. Congrats, y'all.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that. Yeah, that was so sweet.
And before we actually jump into the topic, I would love to hear a little more about your role as senior embedded planner and what that means for folks, if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit.
Absolutely, Sam. Well, the last time we talked on the Urban Planning is Not Boring podcast, it was about embedded planning praxis, street level planning that we co-created here in the Los Angeles area, in the Florence Firestone community. That movement in planning is now international. We have folks across the United States and as far down south as Brazil doing embedded planning. So the movement is now worldwide. And in that time, I was able to join Four Leaf, which is a community development firm that does urban planning and so much more up and down the state of California and along the West Coast. They were developing out their advanced planning and long-range planning team, and they happened to all be fans and readers of embedded planning. So when an opening came, we talked and I joined, and I was given the ability to create my own title, Senior Embedded Planner. So what I do now is advance embedded planning wherever we're working. So we have projects in a couple different spaces and places in California. We're bidding on projects. We are leaning into embedded planning. And wherever we're doing our long-range planning work, embedded planning is kind of the guiding values of being a planner with feet on the street. So it's really nice at this point, you know, basically like 20 years now in practice, to finally have that full level of support.
That's amazing. I'm really glad that is being recognized internationally and that you have the opportunity to kind of craft your job around this practice that you've spent so much time developing. So congratulations to you as well.
Thank you
for everything you've accomplished.
Much appreciated.
Of course. But let's get into this topic. So you recently appeared on this podcast that Natalie mentioned to talk about hostile architecture. And I think it's something that like Natalie and I have talked about a lot, especially in an urban design class that we took in grad school, and just like observing that kind of infrastructure out and about. But for people who don't know, we'd love to talk through a little bit about like what hostile architecture is and who it's mainly impacting, and some kind of unique ways that hostile architecture can play out in the built environment. So if you wouldn't mind kind of giving an overview of hostile architecture and the impacts that it's having, that would be awesome.
Absolutely. Let's start with a definition. I define hostile architecture as elements of the built environment that are designed to deter normal human behaviors and make targeted populations feel uncomfortable in public space. Those normal human behaviors are things like sitting, sleeping, resting, playing, all things that we do in public space, all things that are part of our existence as humans. And the targeted populations are folks like unhoused people, skateboarders, teenagers, public transit riders, and basically people who are considered sort of undesirable in public space. So the definition is very inclusive, and this is a definition that I've written for myself, and I've included in my writings and also in my by teaching at Cal Poly Pomona with our learning about hostile architecture. Several other people have defined it differently, and that's okay. I think there's a lot of debate and conversation that's finally happening about it, about this form of urban design. It's also called different things. So some folks call it defensive urbanism. Some folks call it defensive design. There's a couple different ways to describe it. It has different nomenclature, but the bottom line is we're all talking about the same thing: the built environment made to be intentionally discomforting with a target to certain folks. But here's the truth. Even though it's targeted to people like skateboarders and unhoused people, it affects us all. And that's because all of us move through public space, and we are the targets in that sense of hostile architecture.
Yeah, that's a great kind of introduction to hostile architecture. And as Sam had mentioned, we took a class on urban design where we were kind of told to like create a bench. Like it was just this very like generic, just like, hey, come up with a bench. And it was either that it could go in a positive direction or a negative direction. You could kind of take your own spin on it. And I had this idea about like kind of taking it in the negative and using hostile architecture. So I designed like a bench that had a bunch of spikes on it, and it kind of like morphed its way into just being like one large, like a big spike. Like it was just an uncomfortable like
right.
space.
Taking it to its logical conclusion.
Exactly. Which is like this, is no longer meant to be a place to sit. It's like, it's just meant to be like uncomfortable. And so I remember kind of learning about the hostile architecture, and I've never heard a definition quite like you put it, which I really appreciate, because I do think it kind of captures what we're really trying to talk about when we're discussing hostile architecture, is that it's intentional. And it's meant to
absolutely
deter people from spaces that were originally designed for the public. So I think that's very interesting. But just kind of want to jump into the next question, which is like, from your experience, and again, I think Sam and I are really happy to have you on the podcast in particular, because it really is, you know, you come with this kind of like, your motto is how I always like, I immediately think of this anytime I think of you, is just like, we can't plan from our desks. So you're out and about, you're visually seeing like what's going on in the built environment. So in your kind of experience, from your perspective, what have you seen, you know, hostile architecture looking like? And then what does it typically look like? Like, what are some good examples for our listeners?
Well, you started us off with the great example, Natalie, the bench, the mm-hmm. bus bench, the park bench. This element of the built environment is intended to be a space where anybody can sit and recline, and yes, even sleep. There is nothing inherently wrong about taking a nap in public. So the bus bench is now a frequent site of hostile architecture where it is sometimes intentionally designed from the ground up so that, for example, if it's not, in your case, the spikes, it's the intentional inclusion of additional crossbars that mm-hmm. subdivide the space such that you cannot recline and you have to essentially contort your body to fit into this much more narrow part of a bench while you mm-hmm. hang out in the park or wait for the bus. So the bus bench is one that's probably the most frequently seen. And I think the one that all of us pass by in our daily lives if we're out in public space. But it doesn't mean that we're recognizing it. And that's exactly why we're having these kinds of conversations. Other forms of hostile architecture, any type of ledge, any type of curb becomes a site for skateboarding or for rollerblading. And that's actually one of the earliest observations that I had when I was a teenager. I remember in the 90s when I was a skateboarder, starting to notice the inclusion of metal studs and rivets and other obstructions added to curbs or handrails to thwart us from using it for skateboarding. You see even more obvious examples. Sometimes you see actual spikes on ledges. Sometimes you see obstructions in the right of way. So boulders or really large objects that are placed in the sidewalk so that a person either walking or possibly in a wheelchair, they would have to go into the street to navigate that, right? And now you can start to see some of the mobility and disability concerns you have with hostile architecture. There are even more forms. There is audible hostile architecture where the outside of buildings, very frequently convenience stores, are added with loud blasting music. And that's intended to deter people from loitering or from hanging out outside. There are sprinkler systems that are attached to the exteriors of buildings that rain water down on the public right of way to deter people, but also create slip hazards, right? So there's just so many different forms and iterations of hostile architecture. It's out there. We are all encountering it. And what I've been trying to do from my earliest days of finally realizing what it is until now is really uplift it for the urban planning audience so that we fully understand what it is. And then we can start talking about what do we do about it. And I think we're going to get into it in our interview today. What can planners actually do about this intentional form of discomforting design?
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I have so many thoughts right now based on what you just said, but I went recently to like this random film premiere that Red Bull was hosting about skateboarding in San Francisco. And it was about like how, like the history of skateboarding in San Francisco. And they talked so much, and without using the words hostile architecture, about how they would start skateboarding at like Civic Center. And then they would see like on railings, like little, like not bollards, but like little just like decorative elements pop up on railings.
Yes.
And then they would move to another place and then they would start skateboarding there. And then they would see like all of these different like things meant to stop them from skateboarding throughout the city. And then finally they just started skateboarding down the hills because they couldn't really stop them. It was really interesting. And I didn't really put two and two together that like that was hostile architecture in action. And
exactly.
It's just so interesting.
And I'm like, no, that, elements.
Just talked about that.
Sam, that's one of its elements. So sometimes hostile architecture is subtle. Mm-hmm. Like what you just described, the small addition of a decorative element added to a rail or a ledge mm-hmm. that looks like it's just part of an aesthetic, a certain visual quality, but it actually has an intentionality to push skateboarders away. Sometimes hostile architecture is not subtle. Sometimes it's aggressive when you have more of the spikes or the loud music, right? But that's part of its uniqueness and the way it plays out in the built environment. It's on a spectrum. So you have subtle to aggressive and everything in between. You have not so obvious to blatantly obvious. You have low tech to high tech. And as we advance with, you know, time and culture and with technology, it gets even more high tech and all the more reason for us to discuss it and debate it.
Totally. Yeah, 100%. I think getting a little bit more into the equity component of HASA architecture. What type of inequities have you noticed as a result of hostile architecture?
So this goes back to the opening discussion about targeted populations, with the caveat that in the end, all of us are a target. Hostile architecture targets vulnerable populations, right? That's what it's designed to do. It is meant to push out unhoused people so they can't recline. It is meant to thwart skateboarders. It is also meant to push away people who are deemed undesirable. So if you're hanging out and not consuming, if you're not taking part in capitalism, if you're just hanging out outside of a store but not buying anything, you have loud music in your ears blasting. And even if it's classical music, the volume itself is what's pushing you away. It's a lot harder for convenience stores to blast Metallica because that would potentially alarm everybody. But what they do instead is put Mozart and Beethoven extremely loud. And that creates an audio landscape that the intention is to push away others and undesirables and people deemed loiterers, right? So the design in and of itself has the intentionality to drive you out of public space. Meanwhile, public space is for all of us. I think that this is a point that we planners understand, and it's our job to try to uplift this message. And it's going to be a matter of having difficult conversations, but this is what we do. We have difficult conversations in planning, and we may have to bring disparate folks together. Hostile architecture sends a message of you are unwelcome. And that in and of itself is creating inequities in the built environment. But for other targeted populations, it's I think there's even more of a safety angle and an aspect that we have to think of. Disabled folks, if they have to navigate out of a sidewalk into a street to circumvent intentional obstructions that were maybe intended for unhoused people, but now impact a person in a wheelchair or a person in a walker or a person with the cane or other mobility issues, you can see now that this intentional design choice has pushed a person into the street. Also, going back to the element of showering down water on a sidewalk, right? That may drive people away, so unhoused folks can't spend the night, but it also creates incredible slip and fall risks for anybody walking there. So it does create safety concerns. And because it's this targeted approach, I argue that it creates inequities in the built environment. Finally, and going back to my experience originally as a skateboarder, you know, this approach to urban design where you are intentionally driving people away, there's a nexus to policing and to security, where if you're circumventing hostile architecture, if you found a way around it, or if you're not honoring its intent, it will likely get a police response. So now you have people in the built environment, you know, wrapped up in police and security responses that could potentially lead to state violence and to security and police violence. All of these things we should be thinking about as planners, especially because our work shapes the built environment. And I think that there's something that we can do about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, you know, as we kind of get into the inequities, it's really, you're pointing out so many different kind of issues that arise when we talk about the built environment and what kind of role hostile architecture plays. And I also, you know, really briefly want to kind of address the kind of opposition. So obviously, absolutely, there's always going to be people who are like, okay, but, you know, let's pump the brakes really quickly. Let's think about, you know, this kind of side of things. So I kind of want to address all sides. And so what I want to ask that you address, you know, as we discussed today, is what would you say to someone who is going to argue that, you know, this kind of design is almost helping protect certain individuals and certain businesses, business owners, for example, like as I'm thinking, you know, if you're a member of the public who wants to go to a park and you go, you know, you see a bench and it doesn't have those dividers, but there is someone who's like sleeping across the bench, that's no longer a place for you to be seated. So like, that's not, you know, at that point somebody could argue and say like, oh, well then that's not a space for me. It's being, you know, taken up because someone's sleeping like in a public space. Or if you're a business owner, so in housing, we have this issue arise a lot. As we're developing housing, business owners come to public meetings and they say, okay, well, you know, you're building all of this housing, you're bringing like more people into the community, but we already have this issue of homelessness. And then they bring up, I have individuals who sleep outside of my business and they deter people from coming in and like utilizing my business. So my kind of question is, what would you say to someone who comes with these kind of arguments and says that, you know, well, hostile architecture actually is helping me, who, you know, when we're saying that, like, these are all, we're all members of the public, the built environment is meant for all members of the public. You know, this is kind of that other side of things that I always want to know, like, how do we respond, you know, to folks that are making comments like that?
Yeah. Thank you, Nat. This is all part of urban planning. It is a deliberation. It's a debate. It's a discussion. And we need to come together to have these kinds of difficult conversations to figure out what it is to be in an equitable community. So I'll begin by saying, I understand their sentiments. I am not so removed from reality. I'm not so unaware that I would say that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. The person sleeping in public, possibly in front of a store or anywhere else, I can see how that could create a concern, many different types of concerns, both for mm-hmm. the business community and the residential community. And I could see how skateboarders taking up space in ways that might seem rambunctious could make other people feel uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. All of that makes sense. What we need to do as planners is have the larger conversation about the fact that we are all part of a community. Mm-hmm. The unhoused person is part of the community. The skateboarder is part of the community. Everyone in public space that's moving through, like us, is all part of a larger network, and we're part of a neighborhood, and we're part of shared values or aligned values at least. But in essence, we're part of a community, and we're not always going to get along. We're not always going to see eye to eye. We have different lifestyles and experiences. So that's the underlying issue for us as planners. We have to remind people that we all come from different walks of life, and we're all part of a larger community. What I'm encouraging people to do is, instead of leading with, you know, maybe scorn and being reactionary, let's try to take a moment to understand that life experience, understand where people are coming from. I know it's not easy, but this is what we do as community members. So instead of calling the police on the unhoused person who's found a way to thwart the bus bench because they've stacked up stuff in between the dividers, right? And they've created a level surface, which is a form of informal resistance. Instead of calling the law, maybe have a conversation, maybe invite that person over, maybe understand why they're unhoused. Same with the skateboarders, and same with basically anybody else. I think we should first try to understand these life experiences and lead with empathy instead of hostility. The other thing is this. Every time I've spoken about this, I always remind folks that hostile architecture doesn't actually solve anything. At best, it displaces the problem. The unhoused person will still be in the neighborhood, and they may just have moved to in front of another business. Mm-hmm. And everybody else who's the target of this approach to urban design, right? All these vulnerable populations, they're still going to be vulnerable populations. There's no solutions here. And for that reason, my argument is it doesn't have merit. At very best, it displaces a problem, but there's no solutions. As planners, we need to figure out what to do. We need to figure out solutions.
Yeah. I'm really happy that you said that, because I think it really touches on an extremely important point, which is that hustle architecture is not a solution whatsoever. It might be a temporary solution for a specific area or that particular bench, or like you said, that particular business, but it's not a solution to what the actual issue is, which is the fact that the reason why there are people sleeping on the streets is because they don't have housing, or they don't have access to housing. Or, you know, why there's the reason why, you know, skateboarders are maybe not using kind of more public areas to skateboard around. Maybe there's not enough skateboard parks for them, or maybe that's not, you know, just an area or a space that's been designed for them.
It could be that those skate parks have excessive rules and regulations that make them unwelcoming, right?
Like, exactly.
And you would rather be in public space.
Yes, absolutely. And there's, you know, I know that there's a reason why people, because of, you know, when you're a person of the public, you come from a different background, you have different interests, you bring different things to the table. When you're coming into a public space, you'll use that space according to how you're choosing to do so. And so I think that as planners, it is our role and responsibility to kind of understand what way people are utilizing space and how we can design it to make sure that it's welcoming for all. So I'm glad that you did bring up the most important point, which is regardless of whether one person thinks that it's good or one person thinks that it's bad, everybody should be able to agree it's not a solution to the issues. And so I want to kind of give it over to Sam if you have anything that you'd like to say.
No, I mean, I totally agree that we should be like leading with empathy and understanding that like this is a band-aid over like a much, much bigger systemic issue that we are experiencing. And I think this next question kind of gets at that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts. But in your interview with the NPR podcast, you said, and this is a quote, "A lot of times city planners get blamed for this, but in fact, it's oftentimes not city planners that are deciding to add hostile architecture. Rather, it's the absence of mechanisms within city planning to deal with it." And you say it's one of your longstanding critiques. And I think you were starting to get at this kind of in the last question, but if you could speak a little bit more to this critique and maybe how there could be increased mechanisms within city planning to kind of deal with this placement of hostile architecture.
Happy to cover that, Sam. I want to start off with giving credit where credit is due. In our now kind of global critique of hostile architecture, all of the folks in more of the critical planning spheres, the folks in architecture, landscape architecture, public space advocacy, there's a lot of us out there. We're across the world. We owe an incredible debt to the late Mike Davis. And I want to acknowledge Mike Davis's foundational book, City of Quartz, and specifically the Fortress LA chapter that Mike wrote in the 80s that reads like he wrote it yesterday. We lost Mike in about a year or two ago in October. And it was pretty devastating for a lot of us because he was kind of our North Star. You know, he was the voice that we would come back to. And for me, I just want to acknowledge this, because when I quit the architecture world and I was lost for a little bit, I found City of Quartz. And City of Quartz ended up being my bridge to urban planning. When I read that book, and in particular, the Fortress LA chapter, where Mike Davis essentially lays out the original critique of hostile architecture, that's how I realized I could do urban planning and I could still be a change agent. Right? Like all my worlds came together. I could still be involved in the built environment and maybe not designing buildings, but rather designing better neighborhoods, more equitable neighborhoods. So eternal gratitude to Mike Davis. Everyone, please buy the book or email me and I'll get you a copy, a PDF, if nothing else, and start with the Fortress LA chapter, because that is really the foundation of all the criticism of hostile architecture. So getting back to that that chat that I had with NPR in Phoenix, I was really happy that their line of questioning allowed me to get to this point, because this is something that I've been saying as an internal critique to our enterprise, urban planning. We codify damn near everything. We have codes that, for example, address how much signage you can stick onto a piece of glass. I remember having to enforce that when I was a zoning enforcement planner at LA County. And we codify and we write policies that address more equity issues, right? You know, how much green space is required. And we also over codify parking, for that matter. So the planning world, the enterprise that we're a part of, we have a lot of ability to shape the built environment. That's what we do. And yet, even though hostile architecture has now really been on our radar for the last many decades, with so much credit to City of Quartz, we planners have done essentially nothing about it. Meanwhile, we all experience it. We're all targets of it when we move through public space. But our planning world has apparently chosen to not take a stance. So the lack of mechanisms that I talk about gets back to that point of, like, what about our ability to write zoning codes and write laws and craft policies and shape plans that say we want equitable environments, right? We do that already in planning. Perhaps we can take it to the next step, and perhaps we can say, let's write municipal codes that either discourage or outright ban hostile architecture. We haven't done that yet on any major scale. And I think it's a missed opportunity from us in planning. We can write it into municipal codes. We can write it into zoning codes. We can write it into long-range planning policies. There's been some movement in the last couple of years. In Connecticut, there was a state law that I believe stalled in their legislature that sought to ban hostile architecture that was aimed at unhoused people. And in the state of Washington, more recently, there was a proposed law that did very similar. And I believe it was an attempt to ban hostile architecture on publicly owned property or publicly owned land. But it was also specific to unhoused people. So we've seen some precedents. Locally in LA, we've seen a couple motions come out of City Hall and also of neighborhood councils, but we've not really seen much beyond that. Mm-hmm. So I see an opportunity for us as planners to come up with codes and policies and actions that actually do something about it, including and up to outlawing it, because it is essentially a design inequity in public space. Mm-hmm.
This is, you know, great response to kind of going into the details about where your kind of critique comes from. I think that's really important to address. I also think that we kind of want to touch upon the idea of, like, where do we go from here? And you've alluded to this a little bit, being that hostile architecture is not a solution. And so I think I'm curious, and I'm sure listeners are curious about, how can we as planners work together with private sector, business owners, and the public to find a way to move past hostile architecture as a solution to something that's actually, you know, to something that can really achieve consensus among the community, but that is actually touching the root of the issues? And, you know, of course, I think there's, you know, the solution being housing for all. That's obviously a big one. Right. You know, you're gonna really have be able to touch upon a lot of kind of those issues when you have a solution like that. But are there other ways that, or kind of maybe not as long-term solutions, but maybe short-term solutions that are related to architecture? Or are you thinking of, like, completely different solutions that you want to talk about? But I think listeners would probably be interested to hear, you know, we have this issue, but what are some of the solutions that we can come forward with? And so I think if you could touch upon that, if you have any, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm happy to. And at this point, I think this is a good time to talk about what we're seeing happening right now with hostile architecture. Mm-hmm. Our fellow planners have not done enough, but others mm-hmm. have, and it's been much more of a grassroots effort. So mm-hmm. one thing that I've spoken about on a couple of the podcasts that I've been on talking about this topic is how proud I am of Gen Z and young people, folks coming up right now that are taking to the streets to critique hostile architecture. And they're doing it in a brilliant way. They're using TikTok or they're using IG Reels. They're using our video platforms. What they're doing is creating video essays that identify hostile architecture, explain it in plain language, and critique it. And with the kind of digital natives that we have, they're able to put together extremely compelling arguments talking about this inequity in public space that are a hell of a lot more effective and convincing than what I've seen from scholars who generally talk to each other and don't talk to the public. And if they attempt to talk to the public, they often talk past people. So I want to give credit to all the citizen journalists and the everyday folks that are taking it to the streets, embedded planning style, right? Doing planning on the ground and being public space critics, documenting it, explaining it, critiquing it. They're probably reaching more people than I ever will. We also just see more people calling it out, everyday folks calling it out. I see this on social media platforms, in what used to be Twitter, and now I see it on Threads. I see it on Mastodon. I see it on Blue Sky. So places where people have conversations, I see everyday people talking about hostile architecture. And I think this is also good because it's educating your neighbors. It's educating people that are in the same spaces as you. And they come across this very evocative term, and now they get to have these debates about whether or not it's important. And a lot of folks who are doing this are not planners. They're everyday people who've come across this and said, why do I have to dodge a spike? What's up with that? Right. So we have that happening. I will also give credit because this is something that is a much more bottom-up approach. There are people, sometimes individuals, sometimes groups, that are organized to go out and remove hostile architecture. I am just stating a fact. I am not telling anybody to do it. I am stating a fact that there are groups out there that go around in the interest of public space equity and do what's called direct action, where they actually take the politics to the street. And for example, with a simple Allen wrench, we'll remove those extra crossbars. Mm-hmm. And they might remove those spikes, and they might disable those sprinklers. And for the loudspeakers that are blasting at high decibels, they might lower it or maybe even remove it. So that's another form of activism that we see. We see people doing direct action to address hostile architecture. And many of them will educate people by going to social media and explaining what they're doing. I think that this is something that planners should at least be aware of, that we have this kind of direct action on the streets. We do have researchers, we have scholars that are covering it. There are people in the philosophy of technology world. There are people in the architecture and design worlds and landscape architecture worlds. There's a little bit in planning, but there's a lot more coming out of our students. Especially I'm seeing it at Cal Poly Pomona. Shout out to my Bronco planners. There's a lot more from the academy where people are writing more master's thesis, bachelor's senior projects. And now I'm seeing even more PhD dissertations that cover hostile architecture. I'd love to see more of that. And by the way, if anybody wants to, I will happily join your committee. All you got to do is ask. If you want to do a thesis on hostile architecture, count me in. So we have that happening. And we at the same time have an absence from the planning world. We don't see a lot there. I have some more thoughts, but I wanted to pause to see if you had anything that you wanted to add or reflect on in that initial set of kind of like what's being done from the street level.
Yeah. I'll just say a brief kind of thought is I really do think that it's so important to, you made a very important point where you were kind of saying how there are scholars that really understand the kind of issue, but talk past people because they're really used to kind of talking amongst themselves and they use jargon that they're very familiar with. But when we have, you know, individuals who are utilizing social media or kind of more present day technologies that where they're able to convey a story that's really digestible, or is that a word?
Yes, Yes,
that
it
are easily digested.
And their work is so much more digestible than some of the 50-page peer-reviewed articles on hostile architecture.
Exactly. And I'm like, you know, it's really, and I do think that this is so important, is when we bring an issue to light, and it also makes me think about this podcast, is like, are a lot of people going to choose to read that 50-page dissertation? Maybe not. But are people maybe willing to listen to a 45-minute podcast or watch a 10-minute video on it? I'm sure they would be. And I'm sure they'd be very interested if, you know, you really are talking in a language that they understand. And so I just kind of wanted to say that I really appreciate you kind of bringing that point up, because I think that when we are talking about, and Sam and I say this all the time, when we're talking about these issues, they may seem really complex, because Sam and I may come and say, oh yeah, we went to grad school to study this, but this is a lived experience. This isn't, you don't need to go to grad school to understand what hostile architecture is. And so I think that that's where, you know, we're kind of bridging these gaps, and we're getting people to understand that, like, you do not need some formal, you know, insane $100,000 education in order to understand a lot of the concepts that we're talking about. And so I do think that it really is kind of bringing in that lived experience that is so important, because it brings perspective and it shows kind of, you know, what people's lived experiences are. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to say that I really appreciate that you kind of brought that point up, but I want to give it to Sam as well, who, if she has anything that she wants to add on.
Yeah, I think, like, along those lines, like, we obviously have used social media to talk about these things and promote, you know, the episodes that we have. And I think it's just been such an important tool for planners as of late. Like, there's so many people now that I see on TikTok that are talking about planning issues, maybe without even knowing that they're talking about planning issues, just like observations that and things that they're experiencing. And I think, like, something that we talk about a lot with, like, equitable planning is, like, meet people where they are. And I think that academia can have a big barrier to entry, and it's not necessarily the most accessible or equitable institution. And so having these discussions on the internet, which, like, a lot of people have access to nowadays and are, like, actively on the internet for a lot of their day, is, like, so important in meeting people where they are and, like, making that accessible. So yeah, I think just really important to highlight that a lot of these conversations are now happening online, and it's really cool to see, honestly. Like, I feel like it's empowering people to make a difference, or at least, like, bring up things that they're seeing and saying, like, this doesn't seem right and I don't really know what to do about it, but I'm going to put it out there anyway and talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can see how you don't need to have the secret language of planning littered with jargon, completely opaque, right? That the way we speak in our workspaces, you don't need to have that to understand design inequity and public space inequity, because once you feel the discomfort of an element of public space designed to push you away, hostile architecture, you can have a visceral reaction and be able to discuss it without needing the vocabulary and the dictionary and the synonyms of planning, right? Going back to the idea of meeting people where they are, incidentally, that's what embedded planning is. So I'm really happy to hear that that phrase has been coming up a lot in planning, because as we say in Florence Firestone, that's what we were doing a long time ago. And now we're doing it across the world with street level praxis. But another way to meet people where they are is to hold community planning academies. This is another idea that I want to raise up for a future potential episode for Urban Planning Is Not Boring. There are so many wonderful educational forums now where everyday community members are being educated and learning about and becoming essentially planners through the expansion of community planning academies. So maybe we can cue that up for a future episode. And I can tell you that we're talking about that in Florence Firestone with our nonprofit Florence Firestone Community Organization, creating an actual embedded planning academy where we train embedded planners. And one of the topics would certainly be hostile architecture, because we see that everywhere. So on that topic, the question of what do we do and where do we go from here, and having potential partnerships with the private sector and with business, all that is key. Because in planning, we try to get consensus. recognizing that it's very difficult to get 100% agreement, but at least attempt for a consensus. And of course, that means bringing in all the different elements and interests of the city, including the business community, right? So we want to understand what their concerns are. We want to understand what the concerns are for folks who like these kinds of interventions. But at the same time, we want to have those frank discussions about how these kinds of interventions in the built environment are fundamentally inequitable. So with that, what I submit is having the discussion that is rooted in this idea. Public space is for all of us. We all have a right to the city. That's a concept that we learn in urban planning school, but it's a concept that kind of we live in our daily lives. We have a right to be out there. We have a right to use the city, to move through it, to play in it, to be a part of it, to shape it. We all own public space too. Public space is owned by the populace. So that means that we have equal access to it, including folks who are unhoused. We all have the, at least the idea of having access to it and usability of it. Understanding that we're going to use public space differently because this is an environment that brings a lot of different people together. So it's not about homogeneity. It's about difference. So we need to celebrate that. And I think that the use of public space, the invitation to be there and the right to fundamentally exist with your feet on the street should not depend on one's social class or consumerism or whether they're deemed desirable versus undesirable or their age or their mode of mobility or their housing status. And getting back to it, I think what we need to do is to work across the board with everybody that's involved in shaping communities to try to make them less hostile and more empathetic for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking about this so much actually in kind of a different way, not from like an urban, well, maybe it is actually, because we always say that like it's your lived experience in the built environment. But something that I've been thinking about a lot is how I feel like we've moved so far away from understanding that we're community. Cause I feel like it's very inherent to in just American culture that like I have a job, I have to go from point A to point B. That's it. I'm like on a mission. So even if I'm utilizing public space, I'm doing it for my own purposes rather than like being out in my community with my community members. And so I feel like sometimes you get kind of bogged down in this mindset that like, it's my space, and you almost have like a question of like, oh, right. Why are you here? You know, you feel like almost a sense of entitlement. And I feel like when I think about those things, you know, I've fallen victim too to like when I've seen skateboarders when I'm at the park, like sometimes, you know, they are, like you said, they can be a little bit obnoxious sometimes. And I've had them like, I'm sitting on a bench and they like, all of a sudden skateboard comes up like on the railing where I'm at. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And then I get very frustrated, right. But then I have to think about that. And I have to think that like, we both chose to come here to this space that's equally open for the both of us. And so, yes, I have to kind of welcome you into the space in the same way that I would hope that you would welcome me there. Cause I'm sure the skateboarder is like, oh my God, why is she sitting on the bench that I want to use? So I do think that it is kind of this mindset shift as well. So I think the idea of having these kind of community seminars where you can get people in to not only teach them about these urban planning concepts, but also kind of allow them to reconnect with the fact that like they're a part of a community. And I think that they need to start seeing people like that, that like, you are my neighbor. You're not just another person here in my space, but you're my neighbor. And I should treat you with that same respect that I would hope that you would treat me with. So I do really like that idea as a solution, just trying to get people to understand that like, you're not just living alone in a bubble, like walking through the world.
Exactly.
It's like you're with other people and you should lean on your community and you should want the same for yourself. So I think you just have like a much more positive life. And I think also you'd probably interact with public space much differently if you did that. And so I just like that you brought that up as like a possible solution. I very much support that. And I always support having you on to talk more about urban planning concepts. So would love to talk about
that
further.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, the feeling is mutual, y'all. And the idea of community and our skills as planners, we have the training, we have the background, we have the knowledge, we have the passion and the desire to build community. So I think that it is squarely within our ability to hold these conversations about hostile architecture, but also to do something about it. There are many different options. Getting back to your description, Nat, I would rather be in a more spontaneous public space, in a more improvisational public space. Much as a skateboard flying at me might catch me off guard, I would rather have that than some kind of overly programmed, oppressive space where everything is surveilled and controlled and discouraged. So these are the kinds of critical conversations that we want to have with our community members, so we can hopefully start changing minds and changing hearts about hostile architecture and its intentions.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to give it over to Sam, just in case she has any closing thoughts before we wrap up here for today.
Yeah, no, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about the work that you do and your knowledge and experiences. And obviously you have a lot more experience in the field than we do. So we always learn from you when we talk to you. So just want to extend gratitude that you are spending time talking to us about this, and we can, you know, help uplift what you're doing in any way that we can. And obviously would love to have you back on to talk about ways that we can all be better embedded planners and have these kind of listening and learning sessions. So that's kind of all that I have left to say.
Thank you both. I will be looking forward to seeing you at the APA California State Conference in Riverside, happening in a couple days, the 2024 conference. I plan to sit in the front row of your session. And, and we can start brainstorming perhaps episode 3. So yes. I also want to share something. Several students have let me know. This is, I get a little choked up. Several students have let me know that they chose urban planning after hearing our episode.
Wow.
And that's just a wonderful thing, y'all. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. And we're so happy, just again, like Sam said, uplifting the voices that are so impactful. And like you said, that the fact that people were, you know, listening to what you had to say and decided, you know, this is the future that I want for myself. And it's kind of like the individual that you brought up, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name.
Mike Davis.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. Mike Davis, who I'm crying right now, so please excuse me, but
it's all of us. The audience can't see it, but
all three of us are crying right now. But I think it's so beautiful to say just how you were talking about Mike Davis, how he had such an impact on you and became one of the reasons why you found this connection to urban planning. Is like, I'm really happy to know that you're one of those people for other folks that are joining this program and kind of getting involved in the career of urban planning. And I'm really happy that Sam and I were able to kind of be like that mechanism to connect that voice. So I feel like that really kind of is the reason why Sam and I are always like, you know, this solidifies the work that we're doing, and we're just always so grateful to do it. So thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you too. We're going to keep building the future of our profession and making it better for everyone in the community. So onward to the next episode.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Can't wait.
Thank you so much for listening. We really hope that you enjoyed this episode of Urban Planning is Not Boring. If you did, please remember to send us to your friends and follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
And remember, guys, urban planning is not boring.
No, it is not.